Proverbs 1:7 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom." The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom. Well, there's been a few stories throughout the centuries and even more recently that have encouraged especially courageous women than the story of Amy Carmichael. And Amy Carmichael she's, if you're an older one among us, you may actually remember her. She passed away after an entire life of missionary service in 1951. So some of you may have actually remembered when that happened. But she was born in 1867 into this great godly home. And she was taught early on that God listens to prayer. That God listens to prayer. Now, do you believe that God listens to prayer? Okay. So Amy, even as a young kid, she was firmly convinced that God listens to prayer. So every night she would pray that God would change her brown eyes to blue eyes. Because she was from Ireland, and everyone had blue eyes, and somehow she had brown eyes. And she says she remembers being so disappointed every morning to wake up, look in the mirror, and see brown eyes yet again. She has so many wonderful quotes that are so memorable. Here's one of them. She wrote, "My mother had often talked to me about the Lord Jesus, and as I sat on her knee, she had sung hymns to me. I had felt the love of the Lord Jesus, and I nestled in his love just as I had nestled into her arms. But I had not understood that there was something more to do, something that that may be called coming to him or opening the door to him or giving myself to him." And she wrote on when she was 15 years old then, that's when she gave her life. She opened the door to Jesus. I got some great pictures of her. They're old pictures. And that's what she looked like, a great picture from the late 1800s. So as she came to know Christ then, she's living in Ireland, and she's just a normal person in the godly home. But what really began to change her life, she says, is when she really began to really see the poor. And when she began to really see the poor, she began to have this stirring in her heart to figure out ways to reach them with the gospel of Christ. And she did extraordinary things. Even as a young lady, she bartered for some land and she built a church to reach the girls that were working in the sweatshops outside of Belfast. And as she worked with those girls, she began to realize that God was calling her to something more, something different, and was calling her to be a missionary in India. But she was not well suited for it. She had a nerve disorder, and as she would apply to these mission agencies, these mission societies, she was always rejected because of this nerve disorder that she had. So what she decided to do, instead of being deterred by that, she moved into the slums so that she would have a chance to visit and get to know the poor and share the gospel with them. And when she was asked why she would jeopardize her finicky health for them, she said, "Nothing is too precious for Jesus." Now, if you think about that, and I don't have time to really talk extensively about that, but nothing is too precious for Jesus. She's not saying that the kids are too precious. She's saying losing my health for the cause of Christ is not too precious of a gift to withhold from giving to Jesus. So she arrives in India, and she opens a safe house to reach girls, especially girls, but later on girls and boys that were part of the sex trade, specifically in the Hindu temples. And she opened a house that's called the Donover Fellowship. It was basically a house to save boys and girls. This is actually a picture outside the house of some of the boys and the girls that she saved. Unfortunately, it's an old picture, but you get the sense of just Amy there in her element, surrounded by these little Indian boys and girls that she literally saved from the temple. And she spent 55 years in India just doing that. And she estimates that she herself, through the house and through that ministry, saved well over 1,000 boys and girls from the human trafficking circles going on there in India. And because of what she did, she was targeted by the Hindu community. She was threatened, she was sued, she was dragged to court. She was, from their point of view, they did everything they could to try to get her out of that area. One of my favorite stories about her, she tells a story that she so wanted to really see what was going on in the Hindu temples. But as a European, there was no way she could get in. So she decided that she would dye her skin with coffee grounds. And she dyed her entire exterior, everything that would be visible, and then dressed up as a beggar just to go into the Hindu temple and really see what was going on, specifically how best she could rescue those boys and girls out of that environment. Now, as a European dressed up that way, if she were to be caught, at the very least, she would have been banished, and at the very most, they would have taken her life. And she said it was worth the risk for learning how to reach those boys and girls. That's Amy Carmichael. Amazing story. And what's even stranger about all of this is how ostracized she was, even in the Christian community, because she would go to these lengths, that she would do these things, and she lost support, she was bad-mouthed, she was talked about, but she didn't care. She loved the Lord, she loved the kids, and their spiritual future trumped every other concern that she had. And she stayed at it for all of those 55 years. So at the end of her life in 1951, when she passed away, a bunch of reporters went to this Donovan Fellowship house just to see what it's like and interview the kids. And as they walked around and they talked to the kids, and they asked the kids, "What drew you to this house?" Now, obviously, coming out of the Hindu temple into the house put those kids' lives at risk. The families were angry about it. This was all part of the religion and the circles there. But when they asked the kids, "What drew you to the house?" And some of those kids were adults, you know, 55 years later. Those kids, now adults, said, "Amma," which was their name for Amy, "Amma loved us." That was the answer. So in probably the most memorable quote from Amy Carmichael, she said this, "It is a safe thing to trust Him to fulfill the desire that He creates." It's a safe thing to trust Him to fulfill the desires that He creates. When you look at a story like that, there's a part of you that goes, you know, where does that kind of courage come from? Where does the courage to go to a country to rub your skin with coffee grounds, to risk your life, to save those kids, to literally save those kids, where does that courage come from? And we read these stories about these unusually gifted, it seems, individuals that have this amount of courage. But where does that come from? Much less, where would that courage come from for us? And that is a very good question. And we're going to be looking at two of these lesser-known ladies today of the Old Testament that are going to show us a few things about courage. And they're going to press us, I think, a little bit on our own courage and what exactly are we so afraid of. So if you have your Bibles with you, please go with me to Genesis chapter 50. Genesis chapter 50. Now, you know the story of these two ladies, Shifra and Puah. You just don't know that you know the story. You just don't recognize the name. So we're going to work on the story here a little bit and figure out what these ladies were all about. So I'm going to begin reading at the end of Genesis 50, at the close of the book, verse 22. So we capture the context a little bit about what's going on. Verse 22, Genesis chapter 50, verse 22. Says, "So Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years, and Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob.' Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, 'God will surely visit you and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So much of the book of Genesis is dedicated to the story of how Abraham's family got to Egypt and how they came to reside in Egypt. And you know that story well. Just a couple sentence recap. Abraham has a couple boys. One of those boys was named Isaac. Isaac had two boys of his own, Jacob and Esau. Jacob had 12 of his own boys. His beloved Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt. And really, the bulk of the book of Genesis is about the story of how Abraham and his boys and sons and grandsons and great-grandsons all made this pilgrimage to land and live in Egypt. And we know a lot about Joseph's life. And he's probably arguably my most favorite character, in part because we have so much information about his life and just how time after time he did the right thing, and time after time he chose the right path. And I remember hearing somebody say along the way that Joseph had to, along the way, feel like he was like, you know, God. He saw God like a daisy. Remember, he used to pull up a daisy, and he loves me, and he loves me not, and he loves me, he loves me not. Well, you look at the story of Joseph, and he's born into a rich, probably the richest man's house around. God loves me. His brothers sell him into slavery. He loves me not. But then he rises to be in charge. He loves me again. But then he's accused and thrown into prison. He loves me not. But then he rises in the prison and he becomes prime minister of all of Egypt. He gets married, has kids. God loves me yet again. He actually named his son Manasseh. And Manasseh means, God has helped me forget all of my hardship. So don't ever think that these heroes in the Bible never had it hard, that they only had it easy and they only had, you know, the Lord went before them and everything was peaches and cream. It certainly was not the story with Joseph. So in this passage here, we read that Joseph dies, all of Egypt mourns for him, but it also very specifically it says that he charges the sons of Israel, when God delivers you from here, take my bones with you. Now, it's for that reason that Joseph sometimes is called a prophet, because he knew at some point that God would deliver Israel. And he said, I believe it so much, I believe it so strongly, that when that day comes, make sure you drag my bones back to the promised land with you. And the book of Genesis then ends with the death of Joseph. Exodus begins 300 years later. And just by the way, when Israel took off with Moses back to the promised land, they took Joseph's bones with them. He'd been in that coffin for 300 years. This is at Exodus 13, 19. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, God will surely visit you. That's a word for deliver you. And you shall carry up my bones with you from here. And so all these years later, 300 years, at that point, 400 years later, they're getting ready to leave for the promised land, and everybody's like, hey, have you seen Joseph's coffin anywhere? We got to drag that thing back with us. And when they left, they not only pillaged all of Egypt, but some person on some cart had to take the bones of Joseph, and they did. Joseph really believed that God would deliver Israel someday. So Exodus ends, Joseph dies with the words, God will someday deliver you. It's going to happen. Believe it's going to happen. I believe it's happening. Going to happen so much. I tell you, take my bones with you when it goes. Exodus begins. 300 years go by. We read verse 8. Exodus chapter 1, verse 8 says, now there arose a new king in Egypt who did not know Joseph. Well, that's a little bit facetious because 300 years went by. Obviously, he doesn't know Joseph. He didn't know him. What he means by that, and what the text means by that, is he didn't remember Joseph. He didn't remember that Joseph had saved all of Egypt. He didn't remember how venerated Joseph was. 300 years is a long time. So just to put it in perspective a little bit, that's more years than the United States has been in existence. 300 years is a long time, and it's easy to forget all that happens. So just as a for instance, just to help us understand how easy it is to forget things, how many signers of the Declaration of Independence can you name? 50, I think it's 54 or 56 signers. Now you'd go like, okay, John Hancock, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, maybe Samuel Adams, you know, the beer guy. After that, what about the other 50? Can't name any of them because 300 years is a long time and we forget and it's easy to forget. And when you forget, you fail to appreciate. And that's exactly what was going on as Exodus begins. It's 300 years later. The new Pharaoh is looking around going, Joseph who? I don't know this Joseph. Never heard of him. All he knew in verse 8 is that over there in Goshen and sprinkled throughout Egypt were 600,000 male Jews. And you can read that number in Numbers. I wrote it down somewhere. In Numbers 14 or something, it says that there were 600,000 males. Now, 600,000 males means that's a lot of males. That's over 1 million people, some say 1.5 million Jews at this point. So for Pharaoh to look around and start to get a little bit nervous about the Jewish problem around him, you can kind of understand. He didn't remember all that Joseph did. He now sees all these slaves. What happens if all these slaves rise up against me? He's afraid. Let's keep going with the story. Verse 9. Exodus 1, verse 9. And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. And so Pharaoh enslaves the Jews. That's what he did. And we don't know from history if there was a slow slide towards that slavery. It seems like up until this point, they were pretty free. They were living probably as Egyptians, probably speaking primarily Egyptian. But something happened with this guy, with this Pharaoh, where he takes them from some status of freedom to become slaves. And if you've ever wondered, like, how exactly did that happen? How did that work? Probably the beginning of that story is in Genesis 47. You can read it later. But that's when Joseph literally saves all of Egypt by consolidating the power of Egypt. Up until that point, Pharaoh was kind of an overseer of loose cities and a loose connection. But when the famine happens, if you read in Genesis 47, it says everybody came and they gave all of their stuff. And when they ran out of stuff, they gave their land for food. And it's at that point that Pharaoh went from kind of a loose overseer to really the one who controlled all of Egypt. His power was absolute, and Joseph is the one that established it for him. 300 years later, it's the Hebrews that become and are in jeopardy of losing their slavery, even though it was a Hebrew that established and consolidated the power. So they become slaves. Their lives are very bitter. He worked them literally to death. But you need to be very clear that the reason he did this is because he was afraid. He was afraid. He was afraid of the Jews. He was afraid of those 600,000 men. He was afraid they would rise up. He was afraid that they would make some kind of contract and join the enemies and fight against Egypt. He was afraid. Fear makes us do strange things. It's been said that every problem you have, whether big or small, is rooted in fear. Now, that might be an overstatement, but certainly fear as a motivation for choices and decisions and trajectory in life, fear, the fears that we have, seems to us to be a very powerful motivator. And certainly in this story, it was for Pharaoh. Let's keep going to the story. Verse 15. Verse 15, Exodus 1:15 says, then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and let the male children live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women." This is kind of like a little jab at the Egyptian women. "For they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." He dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all of his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." Chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took his wife, a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. We know that his name was Moses. So here we're introduced to kind of the, maybe we could call them the heroines of the story. And you probably know the story. It's not an unfamiliar story to you. It's just that the names probably haven't really stuck with you. Shiphrah and Puah are these two midwives. There are only 6 verses in all the Bible that deal with these two ladies, but they've been venerated for 3,000 years, especially for their courage. And it's their courage to stand up to Pharaoh, and their courage to respect life, and their courage to fear God. And that courage has made them these kind of venerated, well-thought-of women. So who exactly were they? Well, there's been all kinds of debate about exactly who they were. So let's walk through some parts of that story. In verse 15, depending on what translation you have, it makes some decisions for you. But I need to help you understand that maybe that's not exactly right. In the ESV that I read from here, it says that Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, said to the Hebrew midwives. Now, in that kind of a phrase, Hebrew is functioning as an adjective referring to the midwife. So these were midwives who were Hebrews, Hebrew midwives. But there are other translations, like if you have a Good News translation or other ones, that translate it differently. They say that the king of Pharaoh said to the midwives who helped the Hebrew women. Now in that case, these were women of unknown race, unknown origin, that were the helpers to the Hebrew women who were going through labor and delivery. So we don't really know exactly if they were Hebrew or if they were of probably not Egyptian descent, but maybe they were some other kind of slave from some other kind of place. We don't really know. Shiphrah, that name actually means beautiful. Puah is a name that means radiant. But whether or not they were Jews, we don't really know. What's interesting about that, the name Puah is actually the name of one of Issachar's sons years ago. So it was a Semitic name. Very well could have been that these were Jewish women. But it also seems in the story that these women helped the Egyptian women, perhaps other women, through the labor and delivery process, which would have been very strange to give that kind of a responsibility to a slave, which the Jews were slaves at that time. So in the end, we don't really know what race they were. Now, it also seems strange, I think, how these women, it says that they brought in the midwives. Now, at this point, there's probably 1.5 million, well over 1 million Jews. Certainly, these two women could have been the only two midwives for all of the Jews. So evidently, the best guess that we have is that there was some kind of a midwifery network, of which these two women, Shiphrah and Puah, were the head of the network, kind of like CEO and president. And they oversaw a network of other ladies that were helping the Hebrew women as they delivered. And that ratchets up, I think, a little bit of the story, because it's not just Shiphrah and Puah that saved all of these boys. It was them as leaders and the wives and the women that they led in the network, and somehow they convinced all of the ladies in the network to stand against Pharaoh and to stand for life. It's incredible what these women did. So evidently they were really good at their job because the king, verse 15, calls them in. He seems to know who they were, knows them by name, and has this talk with them. So evidently that network was really something. So Pharaoh calls them in, and he says, here's what I want you to do. When the women are on the birth stool, which was the way that the birth process, the delivery process worked for them, when they're on the birth stool and that baby is born into your hands, if it is a boy, kill it, kill him. If it is a girl, let her live. Now, just if you're taking notes, this is his second attempt to do something about the Jewish problem. The first one was to enslave all the Jews. This is now the second attempt. And in his second attempt, he works a little bit differently. He works at what we would call infanticide or genocide, or even some of the newer phrases, we could probably say like a late-term abortion, a partial birth abortion in that way. Either way, it's the choice of the person who is doing the delivery to decide the fate of the baby. And in this case, these midwives, as that baby was delivered, somehow maybe they had soldiers in the room to hold back dad and to hold back mom. I don't know how that worked, but the idea was when that baby is born, if it is a male, you are to kill that baby right then and there. And so Pharaoh said, kill the boys. His idea is kill the boys, save Egypt. So we're going to kill the boys, we're going to save Egypt, and you guys are going to do it for me. Now go do it. So ladies leave the throne room. And then we have verse 17. And let's make sure we read it again to really make sure we understand what it's saying. Verse 17 says, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded, but let the male children live. What this verse says is that the midwives feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. Now let that sink in. They feared God more than they feared God on earth, which is what the Pharaoh was. More than the most powerful man, more than the king, more than the guy who would decide the fate of their future, the one that could say, snap his fingers, you're dead. They feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. Now, fear in this sense here does not mean like shaking in your booties, watch a horror movie, I'm really scared kind of thing. It's not being scared of God. In fact, in the Bible, 300 times this idea of the fear of the Lord are tied together. 300 times, that's a ton of times. 300 times. So we have got to nail exactly what this means. And the reason we have to nail it here and now today is because we as a culture and we as a people and we as Christians have become far too flippant about our relationship with God. And I love the ideas as Jesus and me and we're walking along the ocean. I love those ideas. But if you get to the next level, God is a terribly awesome, massive being. And we've lost that sense of reverential awe of who God is. Fear of God, then, let me give you some ideas. The fear of God is a combination of holy respect and glowing love. So it's not I'm scared of, I'm afraid of, it's I respect and I love. The fear of God is to have a heart that is sensitive to his godness, which is his power, his being, and his goodness, both together. The fear of God means to experience this awe of him, but then also this like joy and satisfaction in him. So again, the fear of God is not I'm scared of him. Some have compared it to the fear that we have maybe of dad. And certainly I feared my dad, especially when he took his belt off because it was time, you know. There's still that sound of this dread in my heart, right? I was like, I wasn't scared of dad, but I feared dad. I respected, I had awe of him. And that is the sense here. So it's not scared of, but it's respect for. It's awe of. And there's something in that respect of and the awe of that changes decisions, that causes action. And certainly in this story, it was that sense of God in his greatness, God in his person, that caused Shifra and Pua to do this kind of comparison thing. When I compare who God is in his being, in his person, in his power, with who God on earth, Pharaoh, is in his being, in his person, in his power, there is no comparison. And so for them, they put their lives on the line because in this comparison, they saw God as so much more worthy, so much more powerful. They had so much more awe and reverence for God that it was no decision at all to save the kids, to defy Pharaoh. And it was all because of this fear of God. Oswald Chambers said this. He said, "The remarkable thing about God is that when you fear God, you fear nothing else. Whereas if you don't fear God, you fear everything else." There's something in how we view God and the weight of his being that changes even how we process our own fears. And so the fear of God that brings God pleasure is not, it's not that we're afraid of him, but that we have a high, we have an exalted view of him. We hold him with reverence. We hold him in awe. We see him in his majesty. We feel the weight of his being. And when we do that, it changes everything. So I would say that a massive respect and awe of God tempers every other fear that we have. Because all of those fears, and we're going to talk about those in just a second, because all of those fears, when we compare them to all that we have in God, there is no comparison. And because Shifra and Pua feared God more than they feared Pharaoh, they defied his command. And we see this all the way through the Bible. Like if we ask, how did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stand up to the king, get thrown in the furnace? Why did they do that? Fear of God. Daniel in the lion's den. How did that all happen? Fear of God. He prayed. King said no, he did it anyway. Why did Esther approach the king? Fear of God. What made Elijah stand up to Queen Jezebel? Fear of God. What made Stephen stand up and preach the gospel, knowing the stoning was coming? Fear of God. So there's something in this fear of God that is so deep that it gets right into our souls and it literally changes actions. And it's not just the guys in the Bible. Even if you look throughout church history, if you look at these famous guys, you know, the Luthers and the Tyndales and the Wycliffes and more recently, even like Jim Elliot, one of my favorite guys, Jim Elliot said, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. It's a question of the fear of the Lord." That's where it all comes from. So what he's saying here is when God is your eternal portion that can never be taken away, no matter what happens, no matter what happens to you in this earth, no matter what happens, God is your eternal portion. It changes how you process life. Because if you have Jesus and he's your eternal portion forever, in the end you win no matter what happens. Suddenly all of the stuff and the fears of this life slowly dissipate away because you have Jesus in the end and you win in the end. It changes everything when you realize and have this respect for and awe of God. And there's so many great examples. You know, the Hebrew writer, so many people love that he quotes Psalm 118, "The Lord is on my side, I will not fear. What can man do?" If you have God and you win in the end and he's your portion forever and it's forever in eternity with Jesus forever, what can man really do? What could really go so bad in this life that it would cause the fear of this to trump the fear of God? And that really is the question. When you have Jesus, what can this life do to you? Like literally, if you have Jesus, what is the worst thing that can happen? Let me give you an example. I never knew three of my four grandparents. They all died before I was born. They all died of cancer. Which means for me and my house growing up, cancer was always a big word. I have uncles and aunts that died of cancer. There's tons of cancer in my family. So there's a lot of my extended family relatives that they do all of the tests that usually you do once you get a little bit older. They start doing them way early, you know, the colonoscopies and the mammograms and all of those. They were doing them way early because there's so much cancer in my family. So I've always had this kind of fear that this C word would drop on me, that it would be kind of like my turn. And the way I fight that fear in my own little mind is by preaching this very truth to myself. If I have the Lord, He's my portion forever, then I fear nothing else. So literally, I have to like preach to myself and say to myself, what is the worst thing that can happen? So what if it is my chance, my turn? It's my C word. It's my turn. What is the worst thing that could happen? Now, if you answer that question, you run down this path, follow me a little bit in my either lack of logic or logic, but here it comes. What's the worst thing that can happen? I could die. Right? I could die. That could happen. But then what? What happens after I die? I get Jesus. And I get Jesus forever. Forever. In heaven. With Him. Forever. So what do I really lose? Even if I get cancer, even if I die, what is it that I really lose? And so the way my mind works and the way we have these discussions in our own minds, we think, okay, well, if I were to die and I'm knocking on 50, I'm going to lose some things. I'm going to probably not know my grandkids, and I'm going to lose out on some parties and family times, and I'm going to lose some things for a few years. But if I really believe in the depth of my heart that eternity is forever, forever, missing out on a few slivers here compared to eternity with it, with Jesus, with those that I love, what do I really lose here, even if the worst happens to me? See, that's the question. It's one thing to say, do you fear the Lord? I mean, do you really fear Him? It's another thing to have the tendrils of that teaching get into our souls. And to say, no matter what happens in this life, if I have Jesus, I win. So what have I to fear? What have I to fear, even if it is a diagnosis? Even if it is standing before Pharaoh who says, kill the boys, what have I to fear? All right, maybe he takes my life. But I get God, I get Jesus forever. And I think when you really believe that in the core of your being, it really begins to change things. Now, I'd love to stand here and say, yeah, I have no fears at all. I have lots of fears. I have two girls that are going to be in college next year. I fear for my wallet. So I have, you know, things that I'm afraid of. But I think that there's really a continuum. And I would love to say and set it up in like, do you or don't you? But I don't think in reality that's the way it works. I think the reality is more like that there's an ebb and a flow to our life. And there are days that we feel the weight and the glory of God. And then there's some other days that our fears come in and they press against us in such a way that sometimes in the morning, man, it's just me and Jesus and nothing can shake me. But then the afternoon, I get tired and I get weak and then my fears creep in only to be in the evening again. And it's like, you know, it's like a tennis match and back and forth and back and forth it goes. And I think that's more of the reality. It's not do you or don't you, but how are you on this scale? How is it moving for you? How is the ebb and flow in your own life? And it goes up and down. Which is why I desperately need to realign every day my affections. Every day. My emotions betray me. My brain goes the wrong way. My fears loom. And so every moment, every day, I have got to be in the Word. I have got to be with Jesus. Otherwise, I'm not going to feel the weight of His glory. I'm not going to have that fear. I'm not going to have that awe. I'm not going to revere Him at all if I just sit here on a Sunday morning and spend no time with Him throughout the week. And then wonder why my fears are pressing in on me. Wonder why I'm anxious about everything. Could it be that the reason we don't fear the Lord is because we don't fear the Lord? And we got to work at that. So listen, I think that the more you fear the Lord, the safer you feel. The more you fear the Lord, the safer you feel. Day to day, no matter what comes. Because if you're safe no matter what happens, and you're safe with Jesus, what is the worst thing that can happen? You're safe. You're safe with Him. You're safe from anything. You're safe from the big things and the small things and the disappointments and the fears. You're safe. But the way you feel safe, I think, is related to this work at really fearing the Lord. So Shiphrah and Puah, they refused Pharaoh's command. We have no idea how many boys were saved because they did. Remember, they were probably the head of a large network. They may have themselves saved hundreds, maybe thousands. Evidently, time passes and Pharaoh realizes there's still a lot of little boys around. How did this happen? And decides he needs to make some changes. So we don't know a lot of things, but we do know two things right from the text. First, we know that God was greatly pleased with these ladies. He was pleased that because of their awe of Him, they literally respected life and refused to kill the babies. So in verse 21, it says that God blessed them with their own families as a reward for respecting life. And we don't know if that means that they were young and unmarried, or maybe they were older and single, maybe they were barren, we don't know. But that word gave carries the idea of excessive or exceedingly. So it's not that it's like He gave a little like token, a little thank you. This is an extraordinary blessing that He heaps on these ladies because of their fear, and because that fear changed their action. And the Lord was greatly pleased with that. And the second thing that we know is that through their efforts, Moses may have been saved. Because when you get into Exodus chapter 2, Pharaoh then tries for the third time to do something to deal with this Jewish problem. Remember, the first time was to enslave them. The second time was this infanticide, kill the boys when they're born. The third, chapter 2, when that male baby is born, the soldiers are going to take that baby and they're going to throw him in the Nile. And when we get to chapter 2 then, there is a relationship between the courage of Shiphrah and Puah and the courage of the Hebrew families to defy Pharaoh's decree and to save their babies. Moses was probably one that was saved. And if you think about that story, Moses wrote the book of Exodus. Moses probably knew Shiphrah and Puah and their courage. And as he writes the book of Exodus, he includes their name for their courage and the courage that they inspired for all of Israel in saving the babies. I love that story. So the greater our fear of God, the safer we feel. And the safer we feel, the more easily we make decisions that instead of being based upon fear and all that we're afraid we're going to lose, we're scared about this and all of our insecurities, we make decisions that are based on a desire to honor He who we respect the most, that we revere the most. So could God look to you to be an unlikely deliverer? Shiphrah and Puah were certainly unlikely deliverers. But could God look to you to be one of those kind of unlikely deliverers if you'd only stop being so afraid of everything? Afraid of the lesser things. Afraid of the things that don't matter. And instead have great courage in your life that says, no matter what happens, I get Jesus so I can face anything in this life. Ironically, as we get through the story of Genesis, Exodus, and the story of the Israelites, the first deliverers of Israel, it wasn't Moses. It was two ladies with courage who feared the Lord that became the deliverers. After all, they were midwives, and midwives know how to deliver.